You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
On a mixtape just around the corner, did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like Songa, man, my song's gon' break.
Hello
like
and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. It is Thursday, January 18th, 2023. Mark Daly and Mark Hamilton here again to talk about Formula One and all the news and all in sundry when it comes to Formula One. And it's a day earlier than our usual drop, but you know what? It's good. You know, I'm kind of in that weekend mode because usually where we're sitting down to do this, Abby, it's late on Thursday night. So by the time I go to bed, it's like, I'm going to wake up, it's going to be Friday. So we're a day ahead of schedule, which kind of means that tomorrow's going to be like one really long day because I'm going to be a day ahead of myself. But it's all good. It's all good. How are you today, sir? You look effervescent.
I don't know what that means. I'll take it as a compliment.
I don't know either, but yeah, sure,
I'll take it as a compliment, but I would admit that I was a little distracted off the top because just as you started talking, I got a notification from YouTube on my phone. So pretty cool. It looks like YouTube pushes out notifications when we start a live stream. So if you're not tuning in, if you're not checking out the live stream, and that's something you might be interested in, chatting with some of your fellow listeners and chatting with us, please come and join. We live stream every Sunday night, every Thursday night, and whenever there's a Grand Prix during the season. But dude, I'm doing super excited. Listeners don't need to hear this. They've heard this 100 times, flying out to Toronto on Friday, looking forward to a really good weekend. But that said, man, we are 36 days away from winter testing, almost a month, 37 days away from the launch of Drive to Survive season 5, and 46 days away from the first Grand Prix of the Formula One season. It is crazy how fast this offseason's gone.
Oh, I know it is. I feel like we're almost like on light speed, approaching ludicrous speed. But can I did pull up the definition for effervescent. Do you want to hear it? So yes. The first definition is giving off bubbles, fizzy, quote, an effervescent mixture of cheap wine, fruit flavors, sugars, and carbon dioxide. And the second definition is vivacious and enthusiastic. There you
go. I will take the second description.
I thought you might. But yeah, I mean, crazy how everything is. The season feels it's literally around the corner. Those car launches now are only about 2.5 weeks away. When we have the Red Bull launch confirmed for Feb 3rd, Williams Feb 6th, AlphaTauri February 11th, McLaren and Aston Martin both on the same day on February 13th, Ferrari February 14th, Mercedes February 15th, and Alpine February 16th. There's a couple other teams that haven't announced, but who cares about them? I've been a little bit glib and whatever, but no, I mean, joking all aside, it is, it's great that the season is literally right here, but not really. But to keep us occupied in the meantime, like you said, 37 days until DTS season 5 drops. But if you live in the UK on Discovery Plus, you can watch the Bernie Ecclestone documentary called Lucky. It's 8 1-hour episodes, and it's motor racing's Wizard of Oz, Bernie Ecclestone, pulling back the curtain on both his incredible life and Formula One, the global sport he created and controlled for over 40 years. I don't know about you, Hammy. Would this be... Well, I guess there's no such thing as appointment television nowadays anymore because everybody streams everything. But Would you be blocking off time if you had access to this this series to sit down and stream this bad boy over the weekend? Are you
No. And there's specifically a reason. One, it's a big time investment. It's 8 hours. And the problem, because I haven't seen it because we're not in the UK and it's not available to stream in North America yet, but the problem as I understand it is Bernie's the only person they interview for this entire series. So it's more or less Bernie rambling on and reflecting on his career for 8 hours from his perspective. And I would love a Bernie documentary, but I need more than the Bernie perspective for it to be meaningful, yeah, impactful, exciting. So I would love
the
if
word
any of our listeners
self-indulgent pops to mind.
So if anyone does give it a watch and you're in the UK and you like it or don't like it, please drop us a line because I'd love to share your thoughts on the air. But I'm not eager to dive into 8 hours of Bernie reflecting on his career.
Yeah, we should also mention that if you can actually sit down and watch this thing, especially if you can do it in like a day or a weekend, you have our eternal respect to be able to pull that off, because I don't think either Mark or myself could do that. So, but something actually worth waiting for and counting down and listening to will be MotoGP 101 coming in February with Ed Spencer and Matty Patterson. So tell us a little bit more what you guys got planned.
Yeah, this was something that was inspired by Juan Solo last week, kind of reached out saying, hey, I'd love you guys to do some introductory work on some other racing series. Obviously, I'm passionate about MotoGP. We thought it'd be fun to drop it in February before the kickoff to the Formula or the MotoGP season. Ed's a big fan. Maddie's been covering MotoGP for a while. We thought it would be fun to do it kind of as a three-person approach. And I think we're going to set it up as like, hey, you know what? First chapter of the podcast is going to be, what is the championship? How does it work? And then what are the teams? Who are the riders? And just have a little bit of fun. And I think I allude to, and I talk about MotoGP enough that it would be kind of cool to give people kind of the foundational groundwork of what MotoGP is. I got to say though, moving on quickly to the next subject, I'm a little bit passionate about this one. We kicked off a contest last week, a contest. We are giving away 3 copies of Alanis King and Elizabeth Blackstock's wonderful new book, Racing with Rich Energy, how a rogue sponsor took Formula One for a ride. My copy, I bought a copy from Amazon. It arrived yesterday. I'm eager to read it on the plane this week. But nobody is entering the contest. So we have the contest up on Twitter. We had a ton of people kind of enter the contest the first day, and really nobody since. So if you're interested, we're giving away 3 copies. So there's a high probability that you might actually win this thing. Just go to Twitter, find our Twitter feed. It is tacked right to the top. It is pinned right to the top. All you got to do is basically follow a couple of people, retweet it, like it, and you are entered. But I would love to see some more people enter that contest because it's an exciting one. And Alanis and Elizabeth and I will be sitting down to talk about that book on a podcast that's going to drop February 19th. So we're going to talk about the inspiration for the book, their research, their experience, and whether they've got another book that they might be writing for the future, hopefully around the Ferrari 2019 engine scandal. At least that's what I'm going to allude they should do. But
yeah,
exactly, so we're excited about that.
Yeah. You know, maybe people are just a little bit suspicious, right? Maybe they think that the fact that Rich Energy doesn't exist in bottles, cans, flasks, you know, jugs, whatever it comes in, maybe they think that the contest is also a figment of somebody's imagination. It isn't. The contest and what we're doing is not a figment of anyone's imagination. Just the actual Rich Energy drink itself is, because I still haven't heard since we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. Still, I've had a couple of people say, yeah, and I never actually seen it either, so who knows.
Daily, the other day, and this is totally off topic, but the other day I had this memory of being a kid somewhere and my parents buying milk in bags, and like you would cut a quarter of the milk and you'd put it in this plastic jug, and I was just like, that must have been like a weird dream because I couldn't believe that was real. But somebody posted the fact that this is a real thing, that in parts of Canada you buy your milk not in cartons but in plastic bags.
I vaguely remember that out here too, like on the West Coast growing up, but it wasn't much of a thing. But I'm pretty sure if you go like if when you're in Ontario this weekend, you know, if you have a chance, just slide into the supermarket and go to the dairy section, because I'm sure sure there's a lot of them there, because when I was in Ottawa last summer visiting family, like, you know, we were staying at their place, so we went out to do groceries a couple of times. I'm pretty sure I saw bagged milk there. So
anyways, yeah, back on topic. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Topic, you know, just random stuff. But, you know, hey, you know, it's all good. We mean it with, I don't know what our intention is. But anyways, Red Bull versus Ferrari. This is via motorsport.com. Since 2005, Red Bull have had one team manager. So for better or worse, love him or hate him. That is the one and only Mr. Christian Horner. 92 wins, 5 constructors titles, 6 drivers world championships. Ferrari, since 2005, 5 team principals, 60 wins, 2 constructors, and 1 world driver championship. So there's a whole list. I love the graphic. There's on one side of the graphic, you got Christian, and on the other side, you have like a whole list of them. You got it. You got Rivabetti, you got Binotto, you got Domenicali, you got Giantone, et cetera, right? It's like a whole procession of these scarlet clad gentlemen. But it's interesting too, like the pictures, are they coming or going? Because Binotto, he looks a little bit, I wouldn't say despondent, but he doesn't look particularly jolly. Anyways, the other graphic that you've pulled up here is the 2022 versus 2023 team changes. So, of course, this is kind of a cool one because it kind of looks a little bit like a lap chart and how drivers move up and down the race order. So, no change to the top three, of course. Verstappen, Perez still at Red Bull, Leclerc and Sainz still at Ferrari, Hamilton, Russell still at Mercedes. Then at Alpine, Ocon is staying, Alonso over to Aston Martin. It's kind of cool, though, when the one graphic where you see the drivers that have jumped around, but the ones that really stand out are the ones that are kind of like the red X in no man's land. Of course, the drivers that are not in Formula One this year that were there last year was Danny Ricciardo at McLaren, Sebastian Vettel at Aston Martin, of course, retiring, Mick Schumacher, temporarily at least out of Formula One, at least if he gets his way, and Nicholas Latifi, who is not coming back to Williams this year. Okay, so let's move on to listener questions and emails. These are always, I love discussing these ones. First one comes from Jason Fletcher. Jason asks, when you watch the races, do you watch the broadcast, ESPN or equivalent, or do you watch an app like F1 TV? Curious to think if the app is a better viewing experience. Well, I think both you and I are going to agree that we're pretty much sold on F1 TV because it is commercial free. I believe it also is in 4K. I know that I don't really pay attention to those things. I just really care. Do I turn it on and it looks really good? And it looks really good. I love the fact that you can toggle on race telemetry and lapse times, and you can flip between the in-car cameras. So it's pretty cool. Plus, everything is there in one place, and you don't need to search around your PVR or you need to go and search for it on demand. So I'm really sold on F1 TV. I think it's pretty good. Plus, you have the archive.
And it gets better every year. Like, this is one of the cool things. Like, Liberty continues to invest. And last year, I think, maybe the year before, last year, they launched the Apple TV app, which is fantastic. Yep. It's not 4K, but it's so good. 60 frames per second. I love it. And I don't think I could go back to terrestrial or broadcast cable for the race because, like you, I don't typically watch the races live. And it's really cool that I can sleep in, get up at 9 or 10, open the app, click play, and be good to go without fumbling it with a DVR or worrying about whether it recorded or not or whether I recorded the right channel. So I'm all in on F1 TV Pro. It was really buggy for a couple of years, but it's gotten infinitely better. Can't recommend it enough.
And I think, too, you can flip between multiple languages for the commentary as well. You get the Sky Sports feed, plus you get the official F1 feed. And I believe you can listen to the commentary in different languages as well, which is very, very cool. All right, moving on to the next question comes from Rhett Jackson. Question for your recording. With the departure of multiple drivers on the grid this offseason, who do you believe is in the hot seat this season and most likely to lose their seat in 2023? And then secondly, how do you see Piastri pairing against Norris this season? So, Mark, which one do you want to tear off first and try and tackle?
The timing
part one or part two?
Yeah, let's start with part one. And the timing's good because we just had that comparison. You just kind of walked us through the 2022-23 driver changes. So we kind of have a fresh look at the teams. If you look at the grid, obviously we had four drivers that effectively either left or lost their seat this year: Ricciardo, Vettel, Schumacher, and Latifi. And we have four F2 graduates joining the series: Piastri, De Vries, Sargeant, and Hulkenberg. Well, I guess Hulkenberg is less than an F2 graduate and more making his triumphant return to Formula One. But like, if I look down the grid, like the one that probably screams out to me to be most problematic in terms of, I would say, comfort is probably Tsunoda. Like I worry for him. Yep. And I think part of the reason he still has a seat is that historically very deep Red Bull driver academy is not particularly deep right now, which is why they had to tap into DeVries to fill a seat, and why they were sniffing around some other non-Red Bull academy drivers over the last couple of years. And that's of course why they went to Sergio Perez. But I think that would probably be the one that is the most concerning to me when I look up and down the grid.
Yeah, Mark, I totally agree. I think that it is Yuki Tsunoda, and I don't really see any change at Red Bull, Ferrari, or Mercedes. Alpine is an interesting one, and I don't think that it's so much the fact that either of those drivers might lose their seats, Pierre Gasly and Esteban Ocon, but there's a bit of history. There's been a bit of beef between these two guys, so I think like the inter-team personalities and just how these two might either get along or not get along will be interesting to watch. You look at Alfa Romeo, Valtteri Bottas and Zhou Guanyu. I think that's a good pairing. Zhou, I don't think gets enough credit. I think that for a rookie season, I think he did very well in 2022.
Agreed. Totally agree.
And Valtteri Bottas, sure, he's not like, you know, he's not like a Lewis Hamilton or some of these other vets, but he is a good, solid, fast driver. He's got tons of experience, and I think he's the perfect guy for that team as they slowly and surely march towards 2026 and the switch and the rebadging to Audi. Aston Martin is an interesting one with Fernando Alonso and Lance Stroll. Lance has been in that team for several years now. Fernando, the newcomer on the block. That one, I'm going to be interested along similar lines compared to Alpine, just to see how the chemistry and the dynamics in that garage is with Fernando, because, you know, he can be a bit of a disturbing force, right? And so it'll be interesting to watch that one. Magnussen and Hulkenberg at Haas, you know, a couple of, experienced drivers. I think that that's what that team needs. I think that, you know, the experiment a couple of years ago with Mick Schumacher and Mazepin, that just obviously didn't work. I mean, it was unfortunate more for Mick Schumacher, because right place at the wrong time, you know, the team didn't really give him a good car. And then against a teammate that he was never really going to be, you know, be able to really, well, I guess he could maybe prove himself against to a certain extent, but just as inexperienced in Formula One as he was. So not really a teammate he could learn off of. And then De Vries and Tsunoda, that's an interesting one. But like you say, Tsunoda, I mean, he's had a couple of cracks at Formula One now. This is his third season. We've seen some impressive drives from Yuki. And then he kind of goes through these periods where he's just another car kind of out there, not really impressing one way or another. He has these anonymous spells, I guess you could say. And then Williams, Logan Sargeant, exciting to see him coming into Formula One for his rookie season. And Alex Albon, he did some good things last year as well. So some very interesting things to look on. Then just to Piastri and Norris, that's going to be that's going to be fun to watch. But though, you know, I guess it really depends, you know, how Piastri can kind of, you know, how soon is it going to take him to find his feet in Formula One? The only questions I really have about Lando is, I mean, I do not doubt Lando's talent. I don't doubt his speed at all. It's just like, what kind of car is he going to get this year? Because there's no doubt that this guy is, you know, like a top five Formula One driver. You know, I don't think there's any question about it. It's just that after last year it wasn't a great year for McLaren. It was disappointing, I think, that that they didn't perform better. I mean, you know, given the right car, I think Lando can do really, really good things. And I know you feel similarly about that, Mark.
The relationship between these two guys is going to be fine. Like, I don't anticipate there's going to be fireworks. I don't anticipate that there's going to be sparks, but
Between Piastri and Lando?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. In terms of the relationship, where I think the challenge is going to rise is, I think the expectations will continue to mount on Lando, but I think there's going to be an immense amount of pressure on Piastri, because this is a guy that we tagged for getting a ride at Williams, and then he was offered, publicly offered or proclaimed the new driver at Alpine, and then he publicly dismissed that and said, I am not going to be racing for you, and then promptly signed an agreement, or had already signed an agreement with McLaren. Like, I think the spotlight's going to be on him because of, and I don't necessarily blame him and I'm not criticizing him, but the way he and his team, his media team, his publicist, his management team kind of navigated the F1 driver silly season last summer, puts him in a situation where he's in a much better car than maybe he anticipated he would have been in. You and I were expecting him to be in a Williams or maybe the Renault Alpine this year, but he's going to be in a Mercedes-powered McLaren. I just think there's going to be an immense amount of pressure on him, not least of which is because he's replacing Daniel Ricciardo, who, while underperforming in that seat for the last 2 years, is immensely liked. So I think the pressure is going to be on him, but I don't anticipate there'll be any friction in the relationship between the two drivers.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because Piastri kind of, I wouldn't say manipulated the situation, but he certainly did maneuver himself into that seat quite deftly. And it's a little bit for different. Sure. I mean, George Russell sort of kind of did the same to get a ride with Williams several years ago, but he did it more tactfully. And I think because of that, I would say that there was less expectations on George at the time, because, you know, he just kind of, he made a real good case why he should be given that drive at Williams, right? And there wasn't really anything to lose because they were at the back. He was a young driver, you know, obviously, a hot prospect at the time. So it really was, I think it was a win-win situation. George gets a seat. He's able to get the time and the miles in Formula One. Williams gets a hot young prospect, but, you know, it can only be good for them because, you know, they don't really have the car. But Piastri, it's a little bit contentious, right? The way that he's managed to get this seat and the whole, you know, disagreements, you know, and the whole publicity around it. And I think because of that, that just puts more pressure, like you say, for him to perform. So that's going to be fun to watch. Anyways, let's take a quick break, Mark. We've still got several good emails to go through, some fun stuff to talk about. So we'll do that in a moment. So don't go away. We will be right back.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. We're going through listener questions and emails and tweets. The next one comes from the Nige. Mark Squared, riddle me this. Do you honestly think that Mercedes will be able to make a significant jump in performance while sticking to their no side pod concept? I know they have made drastic changes to the underside of the car, but I have serious concerns that they're just trying to improve a concept that is fundamentally flawed. We'll love to hear your thoughts on the podcast. Yeah, I would agree with that that point of view from Nigel. And, you know, it's funny, right, that they went with this no side pod concept. And the thing is that a team kind of going their own way and coming up with a radical new design is not uncommon in Formula One. What is uncommon is that if it works, everybody will borrow from that concept and develop it to fit their own needs and requirements, right? But the thing is, well, I mean, it remains to be seen what the cars are going to look like for this year. But I mean, I guess the best example of one team really copying the Mercedes concept was the whole pink Mercedes thing with Racing Point a couple of years ago, which was, you know, a lot of people thought that they literally borrowed to a large extent from, what was it, the W10, the W11, whatever car that was. But when you saw some like really good matchups and comparisons, I mean, there were a lot of similarities in the aerodynamics. But the cars were, you know, the dimensions were different. But you know, Racing Point did borrow heavily, let's just put it that way, on the concepts that Mercedes had. But it is interesting because in years gone past, before there was a budget cap, I would think that Mercedes would have been able to engineer their way out of that situation. And now it's not quite so easy as just throwing resources and people and money at it, because, you know, you basically have to account for everything and basically record where every single penny is going. But again, if there's a team that can find a way to be, you know, really smart and find a way to be ingenious with their design and a way to solve a problem, it is Mercedes. So I wouldn't count them out, but I'm not 100% convinced that concept is, you know, it's what they, it's going to deliver what they're hoping it will. But, you know, I remain to open to being proven wrong.
Dale, you make a really great point about the cost cap, and basically, historically, they've been able to engineer their way out of problems very, very quickly, and sometimes before I think the general media and the public would even be aware there was an issue, because they could simply throw money at the problem and their massive engineering resources, and Brackley would be able to resolve the issue. I don't think that last year they really identified the zero pod design as a problem, and I think if you look at their season, their biggest problem leading right into the British Grand Prix was their floors and the porpoising issue. And I think the side pods were probably secondary to that. And I think by the time they had solved the porpoising issue, they had probably not yet got to grips with whether the zero pod design was successful or not. And I think if they had suspected that it was something that they didn't want to pursue this season, that's a decision they would have probably have had to have made midway through last year. And I think with the data and the information they had on the performance of the car, they probably weren't confident in the analytics and the data and the telemetry they're pulling off the cars, because it was all muddied by the porpoising issue. So I think they probably had to make a decision later in the season, and their decision was, let's continue with this theme. And in part, it was because of the cost cap, because the challenge is, we're not simply talking about the carbon fiber cladding on the side of the car. Your side pod design dictates the cooling to the engine, and it dictates the placement of the radiators, and it ultimately dictates the kind of placement of the floor. Like, there's a lot of pieces here. So if they made a decision late in the season that, hey, we're not going to continue with the zero pod design in 2023, that's a huge amount of cascading work throughout the factory. That's not just an aerodynamic thing. That becomes a mechanical change as well. And I just don't think that they were confident in their belief that it wasn't a successful design. So I think, and we're going to find out, like, when does the Mercedes, again, to be fair, the show cars that they roll out for the car reveals are often nothing more than a livery showcase, as opposed to a car that's going to represent what's going to show up in the first Grand Prix of the season.
Great
but
point.
We're probably going to know in the next couple of months whether this is something they're going to continue with, but it's certainly not something you could swap out mid-season. That if they commit to the zero pod design for the first race, this is something they're going to continue with throughout the entire championship, just because there's so much work involved under the carbon fiber to make that work. But I would expect to see it.
Yeah, great question. Okay, next one comes from Diego R. This is more a statement than anything, or is this more of a demand? Anyways, Diego's made his point, Hammy. He's put you on notice. And it says, this isn't a question, but more a suggestion about the Fantasy League. Could you do a league on the Grid Rival app like The Race? We all know how crappy the F1 app is for fantasy. That's all. Keep up the good work. I know that F1 fantasy, you know, it's a great concept, but
garbage. It
is shocking just like how ungood it is. I mean, it really is terrible.
Dude, I was using the CBS fantasy football website in 2005 and 2006, and it's better than the F1, the official F1 fantasy site is today. That's how bad it is. And
crazy.
I was shocked that it was bad in 2019. I couldn't believe it wasn't better for 2022. So, Diego, I hear you loud and clear. Let us explore some options. I would say this. I would be open to using whatever site or whatever app Daly would be willing to commit to, because, of course, he didn't join our own fantasy
league. I know, I missed
last
the cutoff, so despite
throw a little bit of shade. Throw a little bit of shade. So, yeah, let me check it out. I think the incredible thing, though, for us last year was we had 2,100 people
join our
fantasy site. So the Grid Rival app might provide a better experience, but if only 200 people migrate their way over, like, I might be more open to sticking. And I definitely don't want to have two, because I can't manage two. I don't have the computational capacity, but I'll definitely check it out. And if it seems easy and the app's available on all sorts of devices and it can be super inclusive, which is the key, we'll definitely check it out.
100%. Okay. Next one comes from Sean Hugg. Any idea as to what Alfa Romeo could be thinking with their team principal situation? Audi seems to be going guns blazing towards 2026. Do you think the team principal will be a long or short-term hire? Thanks, guys. Great question. I mean, we know that Andreas Seidel recently left McLaren to take on his new role as CEO, or whatever the official title is over there. But I'm really wondering what's going on there, Mark. If And I wouldn't be surprised that maybe that the next team principal might be an interim person. That, I mean, Audi is committing big time, and this is going to be an interesting sort of transitionary period. And, you know, if they have a couple of really stinker seasons between now and when they officially rebadge as Audi in 2026, I wouldn't really read a lot into it, because there's a lot going on behind the scenes. So maybe they do put somebody in, because obviously Fred Vasseur left that team, is now team principal at Ferrari. So maybe they do bring in a person to run the show with an eye maybe doing, you know, headhunting for the ideal candidate to steer this ship towards 2026 and beyond as a long term. But who knows? Maybe they have somebody in mind right now, but that would be a little bit surprising, considering Seidel has joined the team ahead of schedule. So I don't know. I would be surprised if they put in like a permanent long-term hire sooner rather than later. I think that they're going to do their due diligence and their homework, and they're, you know, before they put that person in place. So I would say watch this space.
I'm so bad at slurring my words sometimes. There is probably no team on the Formula One grid that has more work ahead of them in the next 3 or 4 years than Sauber, Audi. You got to consider the workload that lays ahead of them. You have the current Sauber team that is rocking a Ferrari power unit. By 2025, they have to completely divorce themselves of that technical relationship with Ferrari, dump the Ferrari power unit. They also have to navigate that process of Audi slowly, incrementally buying and taking over Audi and integrating the two organizations and the two cultures. And furthermore, Audi has to be able to develop and successfully launch a power unit for 2026. And in the meantime, they've got to, in the background, be designing the car for 2026, while also bringing a Ferrari-powered car to the grid in 23, 24, and 25. Like, there is a massive amount of work here. And I still think Andreas Seidel is probably the right person as CEO to oversee all of this. But I got to think that they might bring on more than a few very, very strong resources to navigate this
problem.
That's
where I'm going to disagree with you. They've got the wrong person in there, because they really should have Michael Andretti there, because if Michael's in charge, they're going to be on the grid and competitive by 2025. You know, I'm just saying, you know,
look, dude, Andretti had his chance to buy Sauber, man.
I know.
And it's funny now, because at the time we didn't really know what happened. I think there were some reports at the time that the existing owner of Sauber got cold feet, and it was probably because he recognized there was probably other bidders sniffing around, and that bidder turned out to be Audi. And I think we have to assume that the Audi purchase price was probably double what Andretti was teeing up, but But yeah, you're right. But yeah, I think Seidel's a great guy for this job, but I think he's got to bring in some serious muscle because they have a major work effort ahead of them.
Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, the last one is from F11 is louder. And we all know that if you really want to crank it up to the max, turn it up to 11. So here's the question. How about this? We are entering yet another season and F1 has not done a single thing about not losing your best time if you bring out the yellow and qualifying. I will park it in Raskas and wait for your answers. So I'm also going to park it in Raskas and I'm going to let you answer this one first.
Only because we talked about this. Yep. I can't remember if it was last episode or two episodes
ago. Just recently.
I couldn't be clearer about this, that I think if you bring out a yellow, if you bring out a red, you should lose your fastest time in that session. If it's Q1 and you bring out a red, your fastest time is deleted. Q2, Q3. It would immediately deter and kill the negative behaviors because we talk about the circumstances where allegedly Sergio Perez put his car into the wall because he wanted to make sure he had a better pole position than Max Verstappen. But how many times have we seen people like Michael Schumacher and Nico Rosberg park their car on certain tracks to make sure that they could secure pole? That is a terrible, terrible behavior. Looks horrible for the sport. It undermines the integrity of the sporting nature and the competitiveness of the sport. I think there needs to be, like in Indy, there needs to be consequences for doing so.
Yeah, 100%. Let's move on now to the news of the week. So Formula One has officially announced that they will not be replacing the Chinese Grand Prix in 2023, which really kind of sucks. I mean, we're still going to get 23 races, which is amazing. But what is obviously negative about this thing is the fact that with the cancellation of Shanghai means that between the Australian Grand Prix on April 2nd, the Azerbaijan Grand Prix, that's always a mouthful, on the 30th of April, that means we have nearly a month gap. I mean, we're gonna hit it pretty hard once the season starts with several races right off of the bat. And then just as we get into the groove and we're all up and running and we're all jacked to keep the season going, we're going to be sitting here for like 3.5 weeks. But, you know, at least on the flip side, that once we get to racing again in Azerbaijan at the end of April, then the races are going to be coming, you know, pretty fast after that on a very, very regular basis, but a little bit disappointing. It's unfortunate that, you know, just the way that it was scheduled, that you'd have 2 weeks in between Australia and China, and then basically another 2 weeks to Azerbaijan. So that leaves a big hole at the front end of the season. So, yeah, don't think there's anything further to add to that bit of disappointing news. So the Miami Grand Prix has announced upgrades, including a new paddock in the Dolphins football field. So the organizers of the Miami Grand Prix have announced a series of upgrades for this year's event, and that includes a resurfaced track and new paddock location on the field of Hard Rock Stadium itself. So they're also going to have a new and expanded VIP paddock club, which, you know, that's always, you know, above the garages in the pit lane. And one of the things that was really criticized last year was the way that the track deteriorated over the course of the entire weekend. So they've, you know, they've done a lot of work to resurface it because that's what the drivers are saying, that the track was in such poor condition. They didn't want to go off the racing line and try and make an overtake. Well, would you like to add something to that? Because this is, you know, they've already put a lot of money into this event to get it up and running, but now they've really doubled down to deal with some of the criticisms and also enhance the facilities that are there.
Well, keep in mind, they're competing against two races in the U.S. now, right? They're going head-to-head. They're not going head-to-head with Vegas in the sense that they're back-to-back weekends, but they have to compete for sponsorship dollars and ticket buyers' money in a way that they didn't have to last year. And of course, there's 2-3 races in the U.S. and 4 if you include Canada. But I like 5 this quote
if you
here
include
from
Mexico
Dolphin
City,
CEO.
Right?
5. Yeah, 5 on the continent. I love this quote here from Dolphin CEO Tom Garfinkel. He indicates that they're hoping to resolve the issue of the surface last year, and they employed F1 circuit specialists to carry out a resurfacing of the circuit. And he says, and I quote, "We could have just come back with the racetrack that we had last year because the goal we set out was to have great racing, a lot of overtaking, side-by-side racing, but the track we had last year had parts where there was one line where there should have been the possibility to overtake, and so we weren't happy with that. We're going to go through with the investment expense to go ahead and repave it in an effort to get it where it races better. It raced well enough according to the teams and the drivers, but we want it to be as good as we possibly can. So that's why we're going to repave it. According to Lawrence Edmondson of ESPN, consideration was also given to changing the track layout, especially the chicane at turns 14 and 15, but ultimately reconfiguring the track will remain unchanged. And I quote again from Thomas or Mr. Garfinkel, we talked to all the team principals, the drivers, F1, the FIA. There was differing opinions about the chicane. Some of the drivers didn't like it. Some of them thought it was fine. And throughout their grid, it was the same feedback all over the place. Some liked it, some didn't, and some didn't care. We went through it with the FIA, Formula One, and Tilke and decided right now we're not going to make changes. We thought about flattening it out a bit. We're still looking at things as we finalize things, but right now it's going to stay the same. So good news, they're continuing to invest in fan experience, although probably more the VIP fan experience. They're resurfacing the track, which is great and should be the least they can do in terms of creating a really competitive sporting atmosphere. I don't like the chicane at T14 and T15, so I would have liked to have seen that smoothed out. But yeah, it's cool that just in their second year, they're spending considerable resources to expand the event. And I also think it's really, really cool that the paddock is going to be on the playing surface in the middle of the stadium. So if you know, in Miami, the track was built around Dolphin Stadium, and they're going to put the paddock inside the stadium. So you can actually sit up in the 300 level of the stadium and look down and watch the goings on in the paddock, which is pretty cool and will probably look great on TV.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. What I really like about that is obviously there were some issues in that inaugural race last year, but rather than doing a Jedi mind trick and trying to make us all forget that these things happened, that they're being proactive about it. They've taken the criticism, the good and the bad, and decided to take it head on. So let's see how that improves or doesn't improve the whole experience and the racing spectacle this year. But it kind of blows my mind that we're going to have five continental races between COTA, Miami, Vegas, Montreal, and Mexico City. I mean, that is it's kind of crazy when you think about it. Okay, moving along. Next one comes from Sam Cooper at Planet F1. And apparently, Lewis Hamilton has been offered, or he's in discussion with Mercedes about a new £120 million contract, which will include a Mercedes ambassadorial role. So apparently, Mercedes have offered Lewis an extension of 2 years, which would see Lewis racing now into his early 40s. So according to the outlet Sportoon, Mercedes has reportedly offered Lewis a salary of 70 million euros or 62 million pounds per season, which would
75 million US. Yep. I think that's about 75 million US.
That sounds about right if you do the math, which would bring him up from where he currently is at 45 million euros or 40 million pounds per year. Where it would be different with his current contract is that there would not be a 25 million euro or 22 million pound bonus for winning the world championship. So that is very, very interesting. So they're also reporting that the salary will largely be paid. That was, I don't know why a four-letter word is so difficult to get out, but it's been a long day. Anyways, the salary will be mostly paid by Mercedes's sponsor, Ineos, which is run and owned by British billionaire Jim Ratcliffe's company. So they have a big relationship away from Formula One, as well as Hamilton as being a part of Ratcliffe's unsuccessful bid to buy Chelsea Football Club. And apparently now they're looking at buying the Manchester United away from the Glazer family, which would be interesting.
Yay, do it.
Exactly. As a Man United fan, I would be happy to see the Glazers get bought out. Anyway, so apparently Ratcliffe will pick up 90% of Lewis's contract, and that would include funds to finance Hamilton's charity Mission 44. So he'd also...
And I'm only going to interject here because this is something I have been talking about for years. It's rumored, and again, Sam Cooper writes this, and I quote, aside from the financial terms of the deal, that two-year, $150 million US deal, Hamilton is also looking for an ambassadorial role with the Silver Arrows and wants a 10-year deal with the Daimler Group, brackets Mercedes-Benz, for which he would ask for around 25 million euros or about $30 million a year. So aside from the racing money, when he's done as an F1 driver, he expects or hopes to secure a 10-year ambassador role with Mercedes-Benz, which would pay him in its entirety around $300 million, which is something we've been advocating for on his behalf. So it would be very fitting for somebody who helped them win multiple championships.
I'm willing to do it for the bargain price of 1 million euros per year because, you know, 25 is a little steep. I'll do it at reduced rates, you know, but of course, nobody knows who I am. So that's a bit of a catch. So they told me they'd let
you
me know.
You never know who's listening.
That's true.
You never know who's listening, buddy.
So yeah, and the next picture I switch over to is one of Toto Wolff. I'm just kidding. So I was just going to say there's a little bit of like synchronicity there, but yeah, strangely, I haven't had very many texts or phone calls from Toto lately, but who knows? Maybe tomorrow the big man will call. Joking aside, the next story is about Toto Wolff, and just going back to this ongoing story that we've been talking about that I don't know if you want to say it made big news, but it certainly has been it's been in the news recently. And Toto believes that the FIA's clampdowns on political statements made by drivers in the future won't be harsh. So we talked about that at length over the past couple of seasons. Toto told the media in a conference, news conference last week, quote, "I think we need to see how this really pans out. We understand that the sports are here not to make politics, but on the contrary, to unite. I have no doubt that Mohammed Ben Sulayem, the president of the FIA, and the FIA mean well to achieve the right things. It's just about aligning that with the drivers have been more outspoken in the past," end quote. So there you go. I don't know where he's kind of getting that from, but he goes on to say, quote, "Every time I know when Mohammed's spoken to Lewis and the other way around, it's ended up in a positive conversation. So I have no doubt that once all people sit at the table together, that things will not appear as harsh as they are being written down in the off season. We haven't talked about the political situation because he's in his off season. And I think that's important to shield yourself from Formula One. And this is very much what I'm doing, helping him to shield once he's back. These things will certainly be discussed with a positive mindset," end quote. So we'll see. Famous last words. Oh, I mean, just going back to Lewis Hamilton, there are these discussions going on, but is this true that Lewis is training for the season at the moment in Antarctica?
According to his social media, of which I have been watching feverishly, yes, he has spent a lot of time in Antarctica with his crew, of which I'm not a member.
Yeah, neither am I, sadly, but that is fascinating. Like, I know that obviously you're not going to get the paparazzi or, you know, like extremely, you know, zealous and over-enthusiastic fans chasing you down in Antarctica because it's a very difficult place to get to, obviously. But what sort of training is Lewis doing on the bottom of the world in the southern polar regions? That's mind blowing, honestly.
Wait, Antarctica's the south one?
Yeah. The Arctic is the north one. The Antarctic is the south one. Okay, so that's geography 101. But I'm just I'm amazed. I think this is the most amazing and kind of peculiar thing. I mean, it's interesting, but it doesn't, like, I mean, I would expect that for, you know, like a lot of other like athletes kind of training for extreme things. I just don't necessarily think it's a very Formula One kind of thing, but I guess if anybody would do it, it seems kind of like a Lewis thing, but I guess I should be checking out his socials a little bit closer. Okay, so moving along. Oh, actually, let's take a quick break, then we'll come back because I want to talk more about James Vowles, the new team principal at Williams. So I want to dedicate a bit of time to do that. So let's just step away for a real brief moment. We'll come back on the flip side after a quick word from our sponsors and we'll discuss further, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hold up. Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
All right, welcome back to the show. Yes, so we want to talk a little bit more about James Vowles, the new team principal at Williams. We did talk about it quite a bit, at length on the Sunday night show. So this next article that we are looking at and reading about comes courtesy of RacingNews365.com. And this is an article written by author Rory Mitchell and his co-author Jake Nickel. And F1 Chief Technical Officer Pat Simons has Pat used to be at Williams, didn't he, back in the day? I believe he did. Anyways, Pat has gone over some of what he believes are the key areas that Vowles and his team will need to focus on as they move ahead. Anyways, prior to taking up his role at Formula One, Simons was their chief technical officer from 2014 to 2016. Jeez, that seems like he was there so much longer ago. I mean, that's why I was kind of sort of struggling a second ago to remember when was he there, but wow, that seems a lot longer than it was. Anyways, Pat had to say, quote, strategy. When I say strategy, I don't mean race strategy, because when people rule by race strategy, everyone knows James for, it's more, much more about tactics. What he needs to do is to have a look at what's there and what needs doing. I went there in 2013 and did that job. I turned it from a team that's finishing ninth to a team that's finishing third. I think that James might well be able to do that. He's very, very intelligent, end quote. And, you know, and that's a great piece of the puzzle, because we talked about that when we were talking about the appointment, that since 2016 that they've really dropped off the mat. I mean, or off the map. And of course, you know, now that we see, look at it a little bit further, of course, we didn't take into account that that was the time when Pat Simons left. You know, Patty Lowe came in, and they've really, I mean, to say that they've struggled to regain some sort of respectability is a bit of an understatement, because at the same time, remember, McLaren was also in the doldrums and sunk into the abyss as well, and they've turned it around and become like a top half of the team, or top half of the tier team as well, right? I mean, they're a top five team, and they did that in relatively short order, and Williams has just not been able to do it. But I think that's it's a short quote, but I think there's quite a few things to unpack in that statement from Pat Simons.
I'll just say that I have this bad habit of, when I can't pronounce somebody's last name, which is how you're supposed to refer to somebody on subsequent references in the news media, if I use their first name consistently, it's because I can't pronounce their last name properly. So I will refer to James as James from here on. But I take back a comment I made a little bit earlier about the Audi Sauber project being perhaps the most complex in all of Formula One. I think James going into Williams and being expected to turn this team into a podium contender is probably the biggest. And Pat Simons, not a fan. I mean, he's quick in this article to make reference to the work that he did with Williams back in 2013, 2014, when, of course, Williams scored a kind of a pocket full of podiums during that 2014 season. Let's be very, very real. They were the primary beneficiary of having the most advanced power unit in the world in their back of the car that year. 2014 was the year that we transitioned to turbo hybrid, and the Williams power, or the Mercedes power unit, was miles ahead of anyone else in the grid, and they just happened to be a customer team. So even though the rest of their package was pretty mediocre, they were able to score some podiums just on the back of having the best power unit on the grid, and the rest of the field caught up awfully quickly. And by 2017, they were a total afterthought, despite that podium in 2017 that Lance scored at Baku. But I think the work effort here is massive, and I think James is going to struggle significantly, because the resources and I think the infrastructures are underwhelming, and I don't think Dorrelton has made a meaningful effort to invest in the way that they need to be competitive. And I think a lot of people assume that was because they were really just polishing this team up as an opportunity to sell on at a significant cash windfall. But I think if James is going to be successful here, it means blowing the whole thing up. And that's going to take a lot of money. I'm talking people, I'm talking infrastructure, I'm talking strategy. This is going to be a major, major work effort. And I also don't think they're ever going to be successful as long as they're a customer team. I think their future as a potential championship contending team rests on their ability to score a works deal, whether that's with Honda or Porsche or Hyundai or another team that we're not talking about yet, that they will never be truly competitive as long as they are an underfunded customer team. And we'll talk about this in a minute with McLaren, but that's also McLaren's biggest obstacle. And last year they finished behind, they were the best finishing non-works team on the grid. But if you're a customer team, it's always going to be very difficult to compete with the works teams because the works teams have the benefit of typically greater investment, but they also have the ability to design their power unit for the car and the car for the power unit. And if you're a customer team, you're forced to adapt your car and your car design to a power unit that somebody else has designed, and you have no input into the weight distribution of that power unit, the size, the packaging, the cooling requirements. So it becomes very difficult. But James has a massive, massive work projects ahead of him at Williams.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is going to be interesting to watch and see. But I feel a little bit more confident in the, you know, his appointment as a William team principal compared to maybe some in the past. I mean, obviously, Patty Lowe couldn't get it done. And Capito, I don't really feel like he made, at least publicly, I just don't feel like there was much of an impact. I mean, I had hopes, what with his background with the, I know it wasn't in Formula One, but I mean, he had a proven record in other series of motorsport. And I thought, you know, maybe he's going to be able to transfer some of that into Formula One, but it's really been more of the same for Williams. But I mean, you don't stick around a team like Mercedes for a long term, like James Vowles did. And it's just some of the commentary since his departure and his appointment as a team principal at Williams, the coming from Mercedes on you know, just speaking on his departure, I think, you know, just speaks to how much he was liked and respected in that team. So going to be interesting, going to be fun to watch, but certainly I think, I know he's going into that job with his eyes wide open. Okay, next story comes courtesy of Andy Gray at BBC.com. And this is some quotes made by former Formula One driver David Coulthard, just speaking about his former team Red Bull and specifically addressing the situation that Sergio Perez finds himself in this year. He believes that Sergio has his own future in his hands at Red Bull. But I believe that what he's trying to get to is that he's going to feel the heat one way or another with having Danny Ricciardo as a reserve driver. Now, this is an interesting one, right? Because, I mean, normally I don't think that you would really feel too much pressure when you have like a reserve driver coming into a team. But let's face it, I mean, Christian Horner didn't bring Ricciardo back to Red Bull because he likes his smile, or that Danny's happy-go-lucky kind of party, you know, persona kind of fits the Red Bull brand, right? Because he's a fun guy, and they you know, they're a fun team that likes to do crazy things. That he's there for that. I mean, Ricciardo is a bit of a reclamation project, but when you look at Ricciardo's career in Formula One, his resume compared to Perez, yeah, Sergio's had a pretty good 18 months, but he's also had the benefit of having the best car with the best engine in the back. And Ricciardo, yeah, I'm very disappointed with what he's put up in the last couple of years. And I'm not entirely convinced that he doesn't have anything left in the tank at this point. But I do think that maybe if he has one last shot to rediscover himself and make a legit shot to get a race seat back, I think he needs to take an opportunity like that, because maybe he can rediscover something when he can just focus on what he needs to do rather than all the fiduciary things like, you know, practice sessions and qualifying and races and all the pressures of being a race driver. He can focus on himself and his driving without having to worry about the rest of the Formula One circus, if that makes any sense. What do you think about that, Mark?
Yeah, I would just argue that I think Sergio's been a massive disappointment at Red Bull. And I'm not advocating or suggesting that there's a legitimate chance that Daniel Ricciardo is going to replace him. But I would argue that all the pressure on in the world is on Sergio Perez, and Ricciardo has no pressure. He already flamed out of his three-year contract at McLaren. He's going now to a team where he knows the facility, he knows the people, he knows the sims, he knows the city. And it's got to be a little bit intimidating for Sergio that this guy who was deeply beloved and cherished within that organization is coming back in a reserve driver role. And all of a sudden, he literally is going to have to look over his shoulder, because all of a sudden, Daniel's going to have the opportunity to sit in the exact same sim that Sergio Perez sits in and drive the exact same equipment and drive the exact same car on the exact same tracks. He's going to get his free practice sessions. Like, all of a sudden, there's some more pressure on Sergio Perez. And if you look at Sergio last year, he didn't finish second in the championship, despite the fact that he had a superior car relative to anyone else in the championship. And he only finished 30 points ahead of George Russell. And I think that speaks worlds to the efforts that George Russell put in, especially in the first half of the season. Mm-hmm. But as far as I'm concerned, that's an unacceptable performance. And I get it that kind of outwardly, Red Bull's going to project a degree of satisfaction because they won the constructors, they won the driver's title, Max is happy, he was given his opportunity. But at the same time, Sergio Perez woefully under-delivered versus his teammate. And again, you can make that argument that Max is just this transcendent, once-in-a-lifetime generational talent. But these are all Formula One drivers, and the gap between them shouldn't be as significant as that. So I would agree that there's some pressure on Sergio. And I've been really cold on Sergio ever since the backlash from Brazil, where I think we all felt a little bit of pity initially for Sergio because Max wouldn't give him that position back. But as time went on and the story started to trickle out that actually maybe this is some beef that comes from Monaco, where where allegedly Perez put his car in the wall and that smoke just kept coming and coming, I've been a little bit cooler on him. So you know what? I would like to see the pressure on him, and I want to see Ricciardo do really well in the sim, and I'd love to see Ricciardo put in some really great practice sessions. And I think it would just be interesting for us to talk about the story as the year goes on.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, this kind of builds on the question from Brett that we talked about at the beginning of the show of like who's in the hot seat. I wouldn't necessarily put Sergio in that category just quite yet, but I guess to build on Coulthard's comments that Sergio's Red Bull future is in his own hands. I would 100% agree with that. But I think where it gets interesting is that, you know, Ricciardo, regardless of his performance in Formula One the last year or two, you kind of putting that aside, he is a different kind of driver to slide into that reserve role. He's not a Danny Kvyat. He's not a Pascal Wehrlein, who are good drivers, but they're not really Formula One caliber, like long-term Formula One caliber drivers, right? They kind of like had their shot and kind of disappeared. And because Red Bull, oddly, despite being, you know, this big massive organization, having an academy, didn't have enough drivers with super license points, so they had to go back to Danny Kvyat and drag him back in to put him into one of their cars, or into the AlphaTauri at least, or was it still Toro Rosso? But I mean, Ricciardo's a different type of person to be a reserve driver, and for me, that doesn't necessarily make it like a hot seat all or nothing thing for Checo, but it does make it a very noteworthy situation to watch over the year, especially if Sergio has a period where he struggles. You know, the speculation and comments will just start to fly at that point, right?
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, we have a ton of really great, passionate listeners in Mexico. And I know they get really excited every time we talk about Sergio. And quite frankly, like, I would love to see Sergio feel the pressure from Ricciardo and put in some monster pressure, some monster performance this year, and in turn put pressure on Max. Like, I would love nothing more than to see that. But I would just argue that, you know, given the machinery that he had last year, not finishing second in the championship was not a good look for his career.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, moving along. Next story comes courtesy of therace.com, written by Scott Mitchell-Malm, and it's entitled, "Has McLaren Hit the Roof for Its Formula One potential for now. Now, this is an interesting thing to discuss, right? Because this was a team that was really had sunk down about as low as you can go, and they've pulled them back to respectability and competitiveness. And last year, is an interesting one, right? Because it was the first year of a new era of Formula One, new set of regs. Basically, everything on the cars was brand new for last year. I mean, except for the power units, but the design of the car and the aerodynamics themselves, and they didn't have a great year. So this makes this year even that much more interesting to watch for McLaren, considering also the recent departure of Andreas Seidel as team principal over to his new role at CEO at Audi. But for me, I guess the big question is: this is a team that, or an organization that really at one point had everything going for them and then, you know, hit some financial hard times and had to refinance and all these things. And I can't, you know, and I know this is more your area of expertise, Hammy. I just can't help but wonder if they're maybe handcuffed to a certain extent by the circumstances that they find themselves in, because one of the people that was really outspoken about implementing the budget cap a couple of years ago, back in 2020, when this was still being discussed and, you know, tweaked and finalized, was McLaren CEO Zak Brown. He was very adamant about what they wanted. And I really wonder if that might be the whole key to where they are, because financially they're not in a great place. I mean, they had to sell off the MTC, and they're leasing it back from, you know, basically, aren't they, from whoever owns it now? And this was a bespoke facility that was designed and built specifically for McLaren. I mean, that was basically, I guess you could argue that the MTC is basically Ron Dennis's legacy to a certain extent, right? I mean, in addition to all the championships and things like that. But why didn't you weigh on this one, Mark? I know this is something that you're usually pretty passionate about talking about.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool topic. And I guess if we reflect back on last year's Constructors' Championship, and this really only occurred to me when I was reading the race article, but if you look at the championship last year, Red Bull, works team, Ferrari, works team, Mercedes, works team, Alpine, works team. The next six teams in the Constructors' Championship standings are all customer teams. So if you look at McLaren in isolation of those works teams, they're kind of the best of the rest. But unlike a lot of motorsports championships, there is no championship trophy for customer teams or works teams and overall teams. Like, there's no trophy for them. There's no incremental prize money because they happen to be the best of the rest. But I like this article because it's a question that I ponder endlessly, which is, what is a realistic ceiling for a team who has to buy their power unit from a competitor? Is it realistic that they ever compete for championships when there are so many disadvantages to being strategically and technically a customer team? And obviously, I think the cost cap flattens that delta a little bit, or narrows that delta, and should make it more, I say more realistic that they can compete for a championship, but I just think there's some real disadvantages here. I would add, though, and this is something that I thought about a lot last summer when you and I were reading The Mechanic with Bird Pinkerton, yep, was the fact that when they were most recently successful in contending for titles, so 2007, 2008, and as they continued to win some weight races up through 2012, they were unofficially a works team, right? Like, in 2007, mm-hmm, and 2008, they were rocking Mercedes power units, but they were also the only team on the grid rocking Mercedes power units, and Mercedes was pumping a ton of cash into that team. In fact, as we discussed before, when they got that $100 million fine for Spygate, Mercedes picked up half the tab. That they were, for all intents, technically, when you're talking about the technical design and development of the car and the power unit, they were a works team. And ever since they've not been a works team, they've really, really struggled. And if you look at the kind of the highlights of their history, of their legacy, it's typically when they've had that really deeply integrated relationship with a power unit supplier. So I think their future is really tied. And like I said earlier with Williams, that if they really want to be competitive on the grid, becoming a works team, and I don't know what that looks like, because Mercedes has this unusual characteristic of also being a road car designer as well. So if you're going to have that relationship with a with an OEM, how does that marriage coexist with the fact that you're also a road car manufacturer? And I think when Audi was sniffing around, it was probably with the assumption that they were going to bottle up the McLaren road car division and bring it under the Volkswagen banner. But I think for them to really exceed expectations and win a championship, they need a more tightly integrated power unit relationship. But I just don't know what that's going to, what that's ultimately going to look like. I do give them a lot of credit because, like you said, they were in massive amounts of debt as recently as a few years ago. They had to sell off the MTC, which I think none of us ever expected was going to happen.
No,
and they've
never.
Done some really great things in other motor racing disciplines. It was really cool watching the Formula E race last weekend and seeing that beautiful orange McLaren on the track. But I think it just comes down to what are they going to do with that power unit piece, because that's really going to unlock their true potential over the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting too, because you stole the words right in my mouth, more or less, when you mentioned that $100 million fine for Spygate, because to me, I feel like there's still a residue of that whole scandal, that even though it's like a new era with different people, you know, running the show there.
I agree.
Just at least for me, like that, I just get the impression that they've never been able to 100% divest themselves from that. I mean, it might be 98, 99, 95% kind of walked away and moved on from that. But I still feel like there's, like I say, a bit of a residue kind of like hanging there from that, because it was unprecedented. I mean, the whole situation, and then also the fallout on it, because you know, when we talked about it, Mark Elvis Presley's book, The Mechanic, when they talked about it, like sitting in the garage at Spa and everybody's checking their phones, and then they all left the track, and then they were called back to the track to go to the garage. So they could basically be brought up to speed what was happening. I mean, that was a very, very interesting part to get that first person recollection from Mark Priestley, because when I mean I found the whole book like really, really interesting, but that had like for me a different level of like experience. Like I felt like I experienced that more personally. Like I you could really feel the emotion and just everything, like the whole gravity of the situation, the way that he described it. I thought it was a fascinating recollection and retelling of that that event. Okay, so moving on, just a couple more just to finish off here. So well, this is a Bernie Ecclestone story, so why don't you take this one away, Mark?
Yeah, I love the story. One of the important things to understand about the Bernie Eccleston era, regime, period, tyranny, whatever you want to call it, was that he was ruthless with the race organizers. This is a guy who would beat and pummel and beat and extract every single penny he could from race organizer partners. And one of the things that the Bernie era was known for was he was signing contracts left, right, and center. Many of these races, like New York, never happened. Races would happen like in Turkey and India for a couple of years. He would extract everything he could out of them financially, ditch the race, bailed on Korea, moved on to different races. He never seemed that he was fully invested in the long-term sustainability of any specific event. And that includes the home Grand Prix of Formula One at Silverstone in the British Grand Prix. There's this great Oliver article here from Planet F1 with Oliver Hardin writing. And he says, Stuart Pringle, the Silverstone managing director, has claimed that working with F1's new owners is a breath of fresh air compared to the days when Bernie Eccleston ran the show. And I quote, under the ownership of Liberty Media, F1 has experienced a boom of popularity over recent years with record crowds attending Grand Prix, new and old. Despite being one of the most historic events on the calendar, the British Grand Prix is no exception, with Silverstone attracting an audience of 400,000 people for 2022. Silverstone has long been at threat from the influx of races in emerging markets, including the US, Asia, and the British GP's current contract set to expire in 2024. However, and I continue to quote here, however, Pringle has praised Liberty's approach for working with rather than against race promoters, throwing some serious shade at Bernie Ecclestone. And it continues, speaking at the Autosport International, as quoted by GP fans, it's such a commitment, the British Grand Prix. The fee is eye-watering, the cost of delivery keeps you awake at night, and the fixed cost basics is extraordinarily high as a result. It's a given you're going to sell out Sunday. We got to selling out Saturday a few years ago, and now Friday is all but gone as well, and that's where your profit is. And if you don't make a profit, Mr. Ecclestone, you cannot reinvest in infrastructure. It was creaking and groaning, Silverstone, because the BRDC was unable to make a profit in brackets from Formula One for 40 years. And he continues, now I'm pleased to say that the owners of F1 take a sensible view that is not in their interest to crush the promoter, and they recognize that the promoter invests all of the money back into the facilities. Silverstone, and this is Oliver continuing here, Silverstone has experienced something of a makeover in recent times with the construction of the Silverstone Wing Pit and Paddock Building in 2011, followed by the opening of a trackside hotel last year. So I think the emphasis, the tone of this article is that, yeah, Bernie was ruthless with his race promoters, and it was very much F1 and the commercial rights group versus the race promoters that, hey, we will give you the events, but we will extract a nickel and dime every cent of value we possibly can. And the British Grand Prix, which has historically been, over the course of the championship's history, one of the most successful races from an attendance perspective, lost money year in and year out because they were choking and coughing all of it up to the Formula One commercial rights group. And his article here is, hey, look, you know what? Liberty's doing some great things to promote the event. We're able to sell a lot more tickets. We're able to collaborate on race sanctioning fees in ways that we weren't able to before. And all that new money that we're earning, we're able to reinvest it into the track, into the paddock, into the garages, and create a better fan experience. So it's cool to hear that one of the long-term race promoters is speaking favorably about the relationship with Liberty, because you know that over the past, really in the last 10 years of Bernie's regime, the British Grand Prix was always on the cusp of being replaced or taken off the calendar altogether. And it's a Formula One calendar is unfathomable without the British Grand Prix. So it's good to know that it's in a much healthier place now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is great news. Okay, a couple more pieces of news here. First of all, Kevin Magnussen and his bid to race at the 24 Hours of Daytona later in January is reportedly in jeopardy because he's had hand surgery. He was going to partner up with his father, Jan Magnussen, who's also a former Formula One driver, and MDK Motorsports team owner Mark Kavama to drive a Porsche GT3 of the IMSA Sports Car Championship opening race of the year. So K-Mag discovered a cyst that required surgery ahead of the Formula One season, which means he's going to have to recover and sit out the 24 Hours of Daytona, which is set to go on the weekend of January 28th and 29th. So I'm ready for this time, Hammy. Here is your MotoGP corner jingle. Here you
I'm
go.
I'm smiling back. Ear to ear. You Thank should you so be. Much. I'm not actually prepared. No, I'm joking. I have one quote today, and the quote is from Mr. Marquez, Mr. Mark Marquez. And I just want to kind of rewind this a little bit. So this is the first 7 years of Mark Marquez's history, his career in Formula One. 2013 was his first year. Year one, imagine this, as a rookie, you won the championship. Year two, won the championship. Year three, in what I think is still the most exciting year of MotoGP racing ever, he finished third. Mm-hmm. But in 16, 17, 18, and 19, he won the championships. Imagine that, six championships in his first 7 years. And of course, the beginning of 2020, the COVID-shortened year, he had the big fall, big injury, had to have surgery. Quote from Mr. Marquez, and I'll kind of wrap up the show with this. It's a new challenge because until 2020, my career had been idyllic, a bed of roses. Now I have lived the other side of the coin, injuries. It's not easy. Because the injury has been hard, I am obliged to prepare myself as best I know to reach the maximum to go to war. So this will be Mark Marquez's first full healthy season since his championship 2019. I am pumped up to see what Mark Marquez is going to be able to bring to the grid. If Honda can bring him a great bike, will he win championship number 7? I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, that is a great, you know, that is the big question is he going to be able to get it done this year? But I mean, it's funny, right, that, you know, he could start in his career at such a young age and have such massive success and then have like his fortunes like literally turn around 180 degrees. I mean, it really is, you know, it's a very unique situation, but I mean, there's no doubt that this is an amazing rider. I mean, you know, I can't help but be drawn to Marc Márquez, both as a motorcycle rider and also the personality. So it's, you've piqued my interest, Mark. I'm going to be watching this MotoGP
season. Lots of updates this year, I promise. Yeah, lots of updates.
Cool. Well, you did send me the jingle back after I lost it after the audio cart crashed. So it's all
lost
locked and loaded
or
here.
Deleted it.
And next question. Even though I'm not American, I'm going to claim the Fifth Amendment because the answer that I could give, you know, I have the right not to self-incriminate. So we'll go with that. But anyways, Mark, it looks like we're at that time again. We're a little bit ahead of schedule compared to the usual show, but that kind of fits in with the theme for this week, that we're a little bit ahead of schedule being a Wednesday night rather than a Thursday. But before we go, what do you have to say to all the good people out there in Formula One land?
Well, we love you all. And we greatly appreciate the support of our program. Typically, I get to say the spiel about the hour 40 mark, so probably more people are here to listen to it today at 1:15. But if you love our show and you listen on Spotify, please give us a rating. It means the world to both of us. And if you listen on Apple, if you can give us a rating, and more importantly, even a review, it means the world. Because as we understand it, ratings and review go a long way to promoting and prioritizing our podcast and ratings and search engines and all those kind of things. So if you could do that for us, it certainly means a lot to both of us.
Absolutely. And we'll just leave it right there because it is that time. So thank you one and all for downloading, listening to the show again this week. It's always a lot of fun to do this. If you want to get in touch, send us an email at scooterf1pod@gmail.com or send us a tweet at scooterf1pod. And that's it. Enjoy the rest of the week. Enjoy your weekend. And we'll be back really, really soon to do this again. That's it, guys. Take care. Bye for now.